Accession number 12149, reel 3.
Captain Sutton, reel 3.
Now, Russell, he became top of the class in everything. He was top of the class in naval tactics, he was top of the class in naval gunfire spotting, he was top of the class in naval signalling, he was top of the class in the whole ruddy lot. Then there came the rest of us, and bottom of everything was poor old Dobbs. I met Russell again later on, and he was very much an elite communications man in the Air Force. Dobbs I never met again. But there it was, we had two RAF chaps on the course and the rest were Navy. That was the size of the pre-war course. That was the number of trained in 1 year. A very small specialist branch in the Navy. By the time that the second year of war, when again I found myself at the Observer School, which was then up in Arbroath in Scotland, we were putting through about groups of 50 every 3 months, I suppose, or more. Vast expansion for the expanded fleet air arm, but the small element on which that was built was that 8 observers per annum. One of the pupils with me was Bobby Going. I hadn't met him before. He and I were appointed, after we'd trained, to the Glorious. And we went off to the Mediterranean, to the Glorious, and joined her in 1938, just about the time that the Fleet Air Arm was being turned over from the Air Force to the Navy. That was a strange period, because the vast expansion of Air Force meant that they were calling back their own pilots for their own expanding squadrons. For instance, the first pilot I had in the Glorious was a flight attendant, Jude Ryan, very good chap. He left within about 3 or 4 months of my joining the ship to go back and join an entirely RAF squadron at home. And we started to get the first of the air branch officers joining the ship and replacing the Air Force who were going back to fight the Battle of Britain and so on eventually. The air branch, as you almost certainly know, were restricted to air duties, but they were made to carry out a certain number of ship duties as well. They were specially recruited for the Fleet Air Arm. They wore an A inside the circle of their badges of rank on the sleeves, and they were deeply resented to start with by the ordinary executive, straightforward naval officer. This is considered to be a dilution of the status of officer, to have these specially recruited officers brought in who weren't fully seamen. And indeed, some people I knew on board the ship couldn't talk to them at all. It was a peculiar situation. You had these officers who are now manning the squadrons, both as observers and as pilots coming in, and some old-type naval officers just said they weren't naval officers, they didn't want to know them and didn't like them. You can't live in a ship like that with a dissension. It was an unhappy situation. But it happened.
This was on the Glorious.
On the Glorious. In fact, the Glorious, in a lot of ways, was a became an unhappy ship. As it had been when I first joined it under Lumley Lister, who became Vice Admiral Sir Lumley Lister, it was all right. It was an efficient, fine fighting ship. He left and was relieved by a chap called Doyle Hughes. Now, Doyle Hughes was a well-known submariner from the First World War. He had made his name in those early submarines fighting up in the Sea of Marmara and the Dardanelles against the Turks and done amazing things. I mean, he swum ashore and laid demolition on enemy railway lines and all the things that the young officers thought were great fun, things like that. He had got himself very considerably decorated, and he was, in fact, to a young officer like myself in those days, a golden warrior. He was a hell of a man who had won great fame in World War I. But he was now a senior captain, and he wasn't the same sort of man that he had been when he was a young officer. He was cantankerous and difficult, and he didn't believe that the ship was efficient. He thought that the ship was inefficient, and he'd go lick her into shape. He had a he had certain conceptions about the tactics we were employing in attacks and so on with the main strike weapon we had in those days, which was swordfish with torpedoes or bombs, and tried to impose them on the squadrons when the squadron personnel knew that to employ his tactics meant rarely that we were going to lose all our lives. He had a violent temper, furious temper. He also had the unhappy habit of propositioning his young officers' wives. I mean, this is great fun, but it doesn't make for a happy ship. I mean, I remember being ashore at a club in Alexandria one day, and one of the young officers' wives came up to me and sat down beside me, and she said, "What can I do? The captain's pestering me the whole time to go to bed with him." I said, "Well, tell your husband." He said, "She said, well, I have." And I've also protested to the captain, "I'm going to tell my husband." He said, "Well, tell your husband, tell him to go to hell. Are you going to bed with me?" But I don't know whether he actually was laying the girls or not, but it didn't make for happiness. It's a peculiar thing when you're young men together like that. You have a particular protectiveness towards your fellow officers' wives in your unit. Maybe you'll try and lay the other ones in the other unit, but if they're in your group, you protect them. They're yours. They're the ones you go and visit. In those days, one did all the things like dropping cards and things. They were your friends. And you resented it as a young man. I mean, you weren't a good experienced man in the world in those days. But that was. It's the morality of the 1930s. And he was flouting it. When we eventually, war started, we went off fairly soon to the Indian Ocean, went through the Suez Canal from Egypt, where the fleet had been based, and were based mainly on Aden, and then with a forward base at Socotra, off the Horn of Africa. There we were patrolling in conjunction with a battleship, what is naval parlance is called focal point of trade, where the trade goes into the Gulf of Aden and then into the Red Sea, because the German raiders were at sea and they had broken round into the Indian Ocean, and we were preparing actually to clobber them. The Graf Spee, in actual fact, got into the southern Indian Ocean at one stage. Dorothy Hughes, he said if he encountered a raider, he was going to engage her with gunfire. Now, this scared us stiff. The ship had a number of guns, but they were basically anti-aircraft guns. He wasn't going to use his aircraft, which is the main striking force, to and hold off from the enemy and sink her with aircraft. He was going to engage her with gunfire. And we young officers began to think that this chap was absolutely round the bend. And he went on with various sorts of things like that that made us believe that he had become really completely unbalanced. He had a rather fierce quarrel with his senior air officer, Guy Willoughby, but most of all, he loathed the senior observer on board, a chap called Slessor, who was, in actual fact, the operations officer of the ship. So you had a captain whose ideas of war scared his officers and who was quarrelling with his senior staff. And luckily for me, I was taken out of the ship and brought home to join a squadron at home. So I was happily out of that ship after about Christmas time of 1939.
Then I think you went on to the Illustrious.
Yes. We mustered back home a number of fully trained night flying crews from a number of the carriers and were formed into my squadron was 819 Squadron, 815 Squadron for the Illustrious. First thing that happened pretty well was that we, a whole group of us, were ordered to the Admiralty to meet our new captain, Dennis Boyd. And he gave us a pep talk, said how pleased he was to meet us all, and that whilst we were waiting for the ship to be finished, she was building at Barrow, we would be used probably for covering the laying of the northern mine barrier, which was meant to be laid contain German submarines from the Atlantic, and also for attack on Kiel and Wilhelmshaven, which were the main German ports. Well, this didn't thrill us. Kiel and Wilhelmshaven were the equivalent to Portsmouth, but even more heavily defended, and very, very efficiently defended. And the idea that we were going to be used to take out the German fleet in Kiel and Wilhelmshaven gave us a certain amount of trepidation. The squadron, 819, formed at Ford in Sussex, and which by then I think was still the Observer School. And then we flew up to Scotland and started our practice. We spent the whole of that first winter of the war doing high-level bombing on practice targets in, I can't remember the name of the bay, it's off West Frew in Wigtonshire, and practicing bombing for our attack on Kiel and Wilhelmshaven. Very cold winter, that first winter of the war. The open cockpit aircraft we were flying in, Swordfish, we had flying clothing, of course, leather helmets and leather gauntlets and silk-lined gloves, but one also augmented it with a terrific amount of woolens, and we even wore woolen balaclavas over our leather flying helmets. We became fairly proficient up there at bombing, but it just shows that at that stage of the war, the Navy was thinking of high-level bombing of enemy warships. We spent about 2 months up in Scotland, then came down to Ford again, and the next thing that happened was the attack on the German attack, the breaking through of the Ardennes and into the Low Countries, and amongst other things that happened was the Queen of Holland arrived at Ford and other people flying away before the Germans, and we were shifted down to the West Country, out of the way, because Ford became a frontline RAF airfield. They didn't want squadrons working up there in the way. We went down to Roeborough outside Plymouth and went on with our training there. Again, a grass airfield. German attacks taking place. One camouflaged the airfield in the way that you probably know. You cut the grass in rotation so that it looks different. Looks like, say, you cut it in four different rotations. Looks like it's four different fields. And you mark the lines between with a bit of creosote, which looks like hedges. And it was quite incredible flying. You'd see an aircraft taking across a bird with several hedges and a couple of fields. We went up to Scotland again, embarked in the Illustrious, which by then had done her steaming trials, and off we went to the Bermuda to work up. I might say that never in the whole of my time in the Navy did I use high-level bombing, although I spent the whole of the first winter of the war practicing it. And never did we attack Kiel and Wilhelmshaven, because the RAF tried it first, and they all got shot down, and they decided not to use us. We worked up from Bermuda, because it was clear, fairly clear, of the German submarines, which were still operating on the eastern Atlantic at that stage, and partly flying off in harbour, which you can do with a biplane aircraft like the Swordfish. The only thing I can remember really particularly about Bermuda at that time was the being out on a practice scouting mission one day, and I found a British cruiser heading for the center of the reefs on the north side. So I went down to her and recognized her as the Emerald, which ship I'd served in the East India station before the war as a midshipman. And I made international U, which in signal parlance is "you are standing into danger." And then I gave her position. And I never seen a ship shift round more quickly. She spun round on her stern like that, instead of heading for the reefs, and made out. And then when I got later that day, I was sent for by the captain. And he said, "Were you on that site, the Emerald, heading for Bermuda?" I said, "Yes, sir." And the captain of Emerald was there calling on my captain, and he said, "Thank you. I was 3 days out of Halifax. I hadn't had a sight. And if you hadn't told me where I was, I'd have gone on the reefs." We finished up our work up in Bermuda and back to the UK, had a bit more flying from shore airfields, and then off we went to the Mediterranean. We did, as happened always in those days, to Italy, having come into the war, one had started to pass convoys through the Mediterranean. We went in through Gibraltar, passed a convoy through, and then on to Alexandria and joined up with the Mediterranean fleet. Now, the first thing that I can remember of that, and I dare say Bobby Goering still do all this, that the incredible impact of a modern carrier on the fleet. Up to that time, the Eagle, the old First World War battleship, converted to an aircraft carrier with a flat deck put on top of her, had been pounding along, trying to provide cover for the fleet. She had, a dozen Swordfish on board, and three fighters, which they had pinched from store in Malta, and Sea Gladiators. And they had been up and trying to spoil the aiming of the Italian bombers, which were coming over in droves. and had no effect really, but they were there, and they gave a certain element of protection and disturbance to the enemy. Then we arrived, a modern carrier with radar, with fighter direction, and with fairly modern fighters. We're talking about the still 1940, early part of the war. We had Fulmers. The impact of this on the fleet was quite incredible. They saw, first of all, one Italian bomber shot down, then another Italian reconnaissance aircraft shot down, then another Italian bomber shot down. And when it first occurred, the first time, when we joined up with the fleet after these first actions, you could feel the whole fleet cheering. It's an incredible feeling. You couldn't actually hear it, but you could feel it. The whole fleet cheering this new ship, which had come to join them in the fight. Incredible feeling. And that was what happened with the Illustrious. She was the heart of the defence of the fleet with our modern facilities. Nowadays, of course, they're so old hat that it's unbelievable. But as they were then, with a fairly modern fighter and with her, with modern, fairly modern communications, again, they had voice communications from the aircraft to the ship and back, which hadn't happened in the early part of the war, and are glorious. If we put up a fighter patrol, their patrol was put up on a patrol line and just stayed there. Couldn't communicate to the ship. There was no way of talking. You were put up there and it remained in sight of the ship and kept on that patrol line. There was no way of controlling it by radar in the Glorious, you see. In the Illustrious, all that was there. There was the radar in its infancy, but still that was there. And we ranged from end to end to the Mediterranean, mostly the Eastern Mediterranean, attacking harbours and installations and sinking ships and so on. The first raid I went on, the natural fact, was against an airfield in the Dodecanese. Two squadrons of Swordfish were meant to be doing a dawn raid on the airfield at Collato in Rhodes. And at night, and we were doing a dawn attack. So 21 aircraft were taken off, and then the last three, the commanding officer's flight, the idea was that the commander then takes off, he puts on certain lights in his aircraft, everybody knows he's the leader, forms up on him, and the whole armada goes off. The leader never turned up. My pilot, and for then, and when I had a bit of that part of the war, was a chap called Terence Spence, who later became the Lord Lieutenant of Armagh. We discussed it together, and I said, if we didn't go soon, we were going to arrive in daylight. We'd all be shot down. We had to leave within 4 minutes to arrive in the pre-dawn period. And eventually, we agreed we'd take over. Although we weren't the senior people in the air, Don Spence then put on his formation lights, and the rest of the formation, another 20 aircraft, formed up on us, and off we led. Now, I was a fairly inexperienced observer. This was my first war operation, and I had expected to do what is called following navigation. I'd expected to follow the leaders and things, and my job was to get my aircraft back to the ship eventually. Instead of which, I had to lead it and get it in there. And I remember, even now, the tension of getting it right. First of all, working out where I had to go, then to make quite certain that I didn't infringe Turkish sovereignty, because the Dodecanese were up against the, more or less up against the Turkish mainland, because Turkey was neutral, and if I had infringed it with a large number of aircraft like this on a bombing mission, then of course there would have been absolute hell to pay. One imagine Turkey coming in the war against us in peak. And then to get it in the right position, because if you do a dawn attack, the sun is coming up in the east. You move round to the west into the dark sector and get your target illuminated in the rising sun when you're coming out of the dark. And I had to do all this without having expected to do any of it at all. Anyhow, the attack was a great success. We did quite a lot of damage to Collato Airfield, and for that and some other actions at the time, I got a mention of dispatches. That was my first attack. We then went on round the Mediterranean doing similar things. One of the things that was particularly interesting, I think it probably is moving on towards Taranto, is in October, fairly early October, I was out we'd been passing a convoy through into Malta, supply ships from Alexandria, and were moving off again to the east, back towards the eastern Mediterranean, when we were doing what was called the deep anti-submarine patrol. You fly out about 150 miles and sort of make a sort of fan-shaped formation with the aircraft and go out and see there's nothing sitting on the surface and moving in towards you, and so on. And I knew that the sector next to me was vacant. The aircraft had to return to the ship. I can't think why. Anyhow, I went on my patrol, and at a certain stage I saw in the sea lines and a bit of debris. And if you're a trained airman, a trained seaman, you read these signs. That's called what's called October, still fairly quiet in the Mediterranean. The gales haven't blown up much. And the wakes are lying. You get a long line of disturbed water which remains disturbed without getting churned up by the sea and by the wind. And there were the lines, the wakes. So I took bearings along these and then finished the rest of my sector, turned and cut across to where these lines were leading, picked them up and followed them, and then found the Italian fleet. It was quite an impressive fleet. There were 5 battleships, 16 destroyers, 16 cruisers, 30-something destroyers, and they were all making up to the northeast. That's towards the Bay of Taranto. At that stage, I was only a junior officer. I didn't realize that we were designing to attack Taranto. And I was terribly thrilled at having found the Italian fleet, and I went all around them and reported them and did all the things one had to do. Everybody knew who it was on the Morse key, because my Morse, although I could read it very well and could make it fairly fast, I had no light touch, and everybody in my squadron used to say it sounded as I was making Morse with my big toe when I was making it.